call a meeting to order, and it's going to be, okay, the bad news is that we're calling it to order, and the good news is that we're only going to go until 9. The reason for that is that we have a pretty significant calendar today, and I think members probably want to get their ducks in a row or arm twist their votes or read the bills and all combinations of the above, because we have a couple of things that relate to the permanent fund in the calendar. I want to make sure I know what I'm voting on before we do that. So we may even end up adjourning before that, because we're not going to be looking for an awful lot today. Basically, comments and replies by the Department of Labor to Mr. Carlson's testimony Tuesday is what we're interested in. And I have some questions, and I think they've brought us some materials, and I guess they can indicate what they are and where we are here. I don't know who wishes from the department to testify or to explain what we have. I have some questions that anyway arise out of some Carlson's testimony. Are you waiting for someone who is not yet here? As many of you as need to should come to the table.
Go for it.
Okay. As a matter of background, I guess I've been looking at one thing we did ask the department for. It's apparently this is the specimen contract that was used between the department and individual unions with regard to the procedures we talked about. And I guess if anybody knows the answer, I only have one question. It's not really a biggie. Perhaps someone else, Charles or somebody else may know. I'm just kind of perplexed by the definition of union member, where they say, for some reason, they have to go ahead and say union member is used. Following reference includes anyone registered with the union for work. Is there some kind of a difference between that and a regular union member?
The first contract specified union members, Mr. Chairman. Of course, we couldn't agree to that. And if we have non-union members registered at the work hall also, we would get certified if they came in as registered on the out of work list. We would have to certify that they searched there for work the same as a member. Because we must under the law register union and non-union members the same. Doesn't mean they'd be dispatched or something. Check qualifications and so forth. But they are registered for other.
Oh, I see. For instance, somebody who is wishing to join the union but has not yet and has never been on a job with the union before or something.
Or they may have worked on a permit or something.
Mm-hmm. I see.
They would be registered on a permit if it's possible. I don't know how many of us are. When they first submitted it, this particular union members, and on that basis, the unions have to reject it because we do have non-union members registered.
Anybody else have any questions about this contract? I suppose the major question that I have, and I hope that the department can address, is first of all, do you think that Mr. Carlson's figures that he talked to us about on Tuesday are approximately correct? I think that you got copies of the materials. I hope you did. And then if they are, we have some questions about the results he talked about. Heat from last week.
Okay, the question I have is correct how?
Well, may I presume that you're not saying this, all these charts that we got from him on Tuesday are wrong. And I hope you've looked at it on Tuesday.
Okay. No, that's not my question. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm thinking of a different. I have been looking at mostly costing out the programs since that takes a long time to do.
Right.
And that's how I have spent my time. I did not verify all the facts that he has on the sheets as to what they would be out of state.
Okay.
I'm assuming that he followed a similar process as we did to reduce them based on the portion of their time.
But as far as you or any of you know, those figures appear to be correct?
Not knowing.
Well, I guess the next question I've got is, from anyone who will answer for the department, what is the rationale behind the result that under which people who are in the lower income brackets and have several children actually end up getting fewer benefits under the sponsor substitute plan under current law. Did that just happen because of a choice of formula, or was there some reason for that, or what?
The problem occurred when the dependent lines were submitted. And that's the question. There was a decision made, it was recommended by the advisory council to believe that a dependent line is normally only used in a program where you consider the benefits in that. I think one of the things that we should bring out is most of the claims that unemployment insurance claims that we have do not have dependents. We're looking at 2/3 of our claims don't have dependents as opposed to the other 4/3. So we have to include all the
Okay, you said the advisory council recommended that the dependent be deleted. What was the rationale that was given to everybody?
The fact that benefits would now be more adequate than they were previously. The dependent allowance was originally installed as a welfare measure. It was taken away from the insurance product program and instituted with more of a welfare program. We're saying our benefits are not adequate. We need to give more money to people with dependents. And so they legislated the dependent allowance.
Now, you've been costing out some, I have some other questions in that direction, and I suppose I'd really like to be asking them, perhaps Mr. Spears, some people who aren't here today, with regard to the policy decisions behind the choice of what's in the bill and what is in the bill. But that aside, I want to go back to that in a moment a little bit. You've been costing out various things we asked for on Tuesday, and we asked for several things, and I know there's I would be very surprised if you're able to get it all done by today, and if you didn't, that's all right. But what do you have?
Okay, I've done a sort of a quick overview of everything without doing a super detailed analysis. I really have all of some general round figures for you today. Okay, one of the questions we had was what would happen when the federal government, if and when the federal government goes, we all conformity and go back and pay benefits. Those interstate payments and those interstate benefits that were reduced. And they tell us we could not reduce them.
This is assuming the passage of the sponsor substitute provision in there.
Okay, Mr. Crosby's proposal also does reduce them.
Mr. Chairman, in some cases, it would reduce it. The recipient has to morally correlate.
But it would be at least it'd be at least possible there could be a compliance problem with either proposal.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, of course we have two types of costs. So we have the cost to the trust fund, okay, when we only do about half the benefit amount we probably should, as the government says we should. There's a possibility we'll have to reimburse the claimants. But we don't know how far when the court case would be decided. So we don't know exactly when. I can tell you each year, as each year goes by, how much there's a possibility we have to pay out. But not knowing when the case would be decided would be a problem. In the first year, it would be a possible $15 million that we'd have to go back into the world. The second year, no more than $30 million. But third year, $40 million.
I would imagine, since this would be basically a decision on a matter of law and not a lot of facts, that cases would be decided rather quickly and any appeals would be disposed of probably within a year and a half, or a year. I guess we're probably looking at the two figures, the first two figures you gave were 15 and 2. So that's the risk that we're taking with regard to losing a compliance case which the department has testified that it believes they would be able to win. It would be questioned apparently what it is.
No, it will be questioned.
Well, I guess they told you it would be.
Right.
You said the cost of the trust fund, and you said that as though there were, you were going to talk about other costs too.
Okay, we have trust fund money, so those pay out benefits. We also have administration costs for the program. Those normally come from the federal government, and they are based on complex formula as to the amount of work, and then we normally absorb anything we do above and beyond that. This would be above and beyond our federal budget. Probably, I would try to estimate what it costs to go back again, depending upon how many claims we have, whether they're an active status, or whether we have to go searching for them to do that. And those probably, depending upon the amount, whether or not it could be absorbed within the budget, would have to come from general fund or something else.
So there's some unknown amount of administrative costs in addition to the possible loss for the trust fund in the event that we were to treat exploitation of benefits in the basin, yes.
I haven't estimated that figure, but that would be a substantial amount of money, because particularly if this would go on.
Well, around here we deal with multiples of tens of thousands, and then we talk about billions also, so which substantial amount would you mean?
To do a search on the volume of unemployment claims that we have interstate, would be very, very time-consuming. And that would mean everybody's weekly benefit amount would not only be adjusted perhaps once, but if they happen to move around to two or three states, it would be adjusted that many more times.
Okay, we pass a bill that changes the exportation either along the line you're talking about, Mr. Carlson suggested, somebody else has suggested, formula, we lose a compliance case definitely within about a year. About a year from now, you're trying to figure how many additional man hours you have to put in. Do you think you'd have to have one person working on it full time for a month, or what equivalent on that basis would you?
I would say it would be a minimum of 15 people for 6 months. That's just off the top of my head, but it's wouldn't be a simple concept. And it's definitely not monies that would be funded by the federal government. And they have indicated to us that they feel it would take at least 2 years to prosecute.
So we'd be looking at, okay. They really feel that. That's strange. It's only in one single issue of law, I guess.
We felt it would be that they would probably start the proceedings immediately, because there's other states looking at our formulas and waiting to see whether we're successful. But the U.S. government moves slowly.
That's a bit surprising. Okay, well, I guess then what's proposed is that we gamble the possible loss of that amount of money. I don't know what a budget for 15 people for 6 months or 10 people for 6 months would be, in order to attempt to save between 15 and 31 million in the first year or two. With regard to what would normally be kept in our trust fund because we didn't pay it off. That seems to be what's being proposed, I guess.
You said all this. Are you looking at this as something that, just in case we lose what we've saved in the new lab,
or
save in the future if it goes and becomes
bigger? Well, I'm just making a comment or a conclusion. It would appear that if we pass some version of the bill that runs this risk. What we're risking is the, if you like, the administrative or the overhead costs, the additional amounts we'd have to put into administering the department's activities in the event we lose. So I don't know what that is, but it's certainly not 15 or 31 million. So it's an attempt to save 15 to 30 million dollars in the trust fund, trying to second guess the federal courts and the United States Department of Labor, I guess.
I think what Janet was pointing out is that the long term would be a considerable more savings than that.
Mm-hmm. And 30 years is about
duration.
48 million. Yeah. That's substantial by almost anybody's comparison, except maybe the people who work in the permanent fund that we're building up there. Yeah, why don't you continue with the other materials?
I spent all last night trying to think of a good way to explain the various costs of each program. I'm not sure if I came up with a very good method of doing it. I'll try. I think the first thing, and the easiest thing for you to understand would be the average tax that it would take to fund each program. Okay, where the program has 10 years. Okay, and that's what I picked as being something that we could all understand when we're trying to sit down and explain to you how an unemployment insurance is funded and all the different terminology we have to go to describe what it's good or bad. Okay, under the existing law, we are running an average tax rate of 4% for employers and 28% for employees. And under our current tax base and current benefits, we're going to have this for a long time to come. Okay, and right now, of course, that only amounts to a $400 tax for the employer and an $80 tax for the employee. Okay, under Costco 550, the average tax over the 10-year period would be 3.3 for the employer and 0.7 for the employee. And of course, the tax base would be the 75% of the average annual wage. Okay, which means your maximum taxes could be $627 for an employer and $133 for an employee, but we would have to earn, let's say, $19,000 to have that tax. Under Mr. Paulson's proposal, we have a tax base of 100% of the average annual wage, which we'll assume is $25,000. The employer tax would be 3.7%. The employee tax would be 0.7%. Giving a possible maximum of $925 per employer is $175 per week.
So it seems that neither of the two proposals have a really vast change from what the current tax levels are and the contribution levels for an employer and employee. I mean, there are changes, but they are not great big ones. From 4% to either 3.3 and 3.7, or 0.8% to 0.7 each case. Something bothers you about what I just said. Go ahead and explain my question.
I'm trying to figure out what I want to say. When I look at the program overall, okay, I look at it from my actuarial standpoint. It has always been assumed that an unemployment insurance program could be afforded if it rent. It stayed about 3% of the total wages in the state. And Mr. Carlson's proposal was over it. Okay, not by much, but just go over
it. Where does that assumption come from? Is that some rule of thumb or
it's a rule of thumb that they have used down through the years. And this is what they felt they could first afford. They discovered the program wasn't that expensive. In Alaska, we had probably one of the most expensive programs. And of course, this would put us by far out in the forefront on the difficulties.
So we're going to be above that anticipated traditional fair figure or whatever it would be.
Okay, and again, we have to think of, I guess when I look at this program, I see, I know where we are, I know where we'd like to be. The question is, how do we get there? And can we make the jump all in 1 year? I think that's one of the problems I have right now, and possibly why the policy decision was made not to go as high as was originally planned. Okay, the original plan on the department side was $200 maximum benefit. Okay, it was dropped, and possibly the reasons were the high cost it would take in 1 year in order to get to that point.
Well, then wouldn't there be a it would, you know, it would be possible for us to pass a bill so that we could have basically two rates. And, you know, if you have a problem, or if there's seen to be a problem with the soundness of the fund or the way the fund is viewed, that we could have one schedule in effect for a year and go to another one the next year and put it all in one bill.
Okay, we had something similar to that. The question here is not a question of fund solvency. The fund will not go broke on any of the proposals. It won't even go broke on the existing law. We'll run high taxes for a while, but we won't go broke unless we have some sort of major problem that we just have for the next few years.
Well, I don't know if anybody's going to stop building an oil pipeline in the next 2 years, so we probably won't have that pipeline. Well, if you're not talking about fund solvency, what problem are you addressing?
I suppose the timing itself, okay, what you can force and ask people to fund the program. Granted, they can fund it, but can they fund it all at the same time? Okay. The TSCA 550 is a sort of an intermediary step. Okay, we've increased benefits, we've increased taxes, but we haven't skyrocketed the other way.
Did the department think about the... I'm not really quite sure I understand that answer, I suppose I better say that. Are you talking about the effect it would have upon employer, or that there's this kind of experience based upon the many years that these programs have been in, that it would be a kind of employer reaction if the taxes go up too high that would affect the economy? What kind of thing are you talking about? If they go too high too fast, or what?
Too high. I think a good way to look at it would be, as of January 1st, 1978, local governments came under, and state governments came under unemployment checks. Okay, they had never been under this program before. Okay. All of a sudden, they were faced with possible costs of several hundred thousand dollars, okay, depending upon the size. Some of them probably close to a million. It's something that they had never budgeted for. And all of a sudden we said, hey, budget an extra million for us because you may need it. Okay, in order to budget for that, they were going to have to drop back programs or lay off people who had been drawing from the chance, thereby increasing the cost. And you could have a sort of tumbling effect. Trying to jump from $400 to over $900 in 1 year is asking an awful lot of employers who pay that type of wages. And the problem will be, where can they absorb it? Can they pass it to the consumer fast enough? Do they want to pass it to the consumer that fast? You have to have some sort of trade-off.
Did the department look at the possibility of going, say, in a two-year stage and have one rate for a while and then go to another rate so that this would not happen too fast?
So that's what we had looked at and what we proposed in our bill. We were going to drop the rate for 2 years.
I guess that wasn't what the original.
And the TSCA 550 is also in the sponsor section to drop the rate.
Well, I was talking about something on the order of actually a different benefit structure for 1 year and then another year, maybe 2 or 3 year step that would in turn have an effect, no doubt, on what the tax rates were. Did you look at that possibility at all?
In one bill?
Yeah.
No.
How much of a headache would that be administratively? Say, if you dealt, if we passed some version of 550 now, and we dealt with one benefit structure until December 31, '78, or July 1, '79, and then you went to a different benefit structure, and if you had a lot of advance notice, would that be?
I would say it would be the same as coming back to you in 2 years and saying it's time to raise benefits, or there would have been more administrative time if you want. Mm-hmm. Because again, we would have notice, we don't have to be prepared for it.
You seem to be saying that
what the department expects, that were some version of 550 to pass this year, that they might well be back in the next year or two with another bill to raise benefits a bit more. Go ahead, I've been jumping in with questions, not necessarily what you your materials about.
Okay, I think through one way or another, I may have covered most of it. Okay, what I had wanted to start off with was to remind you of some of the things that Will Spear had said earlier when he testified, and that is that the unemployment insurance program is a balancing act type of program. You have to watch what you give out and what you take in. You have to watch your eligibility and your disqualifications and what you do within the program. Okay. And basically then is when you change one section, you should change another to make sure that you have a program that will stay financially sound throughout the future. And when the department looked at this bill, when they wrote the bill, when they looked at the program, if that's what they did, they looked at all the parts of the program. They just didn't pick out, so let's raise benefits or let's raise taxes or let's disqualify one person here and one person there. They looked at it as a total whole and said, we think this program will work. We'll tighten up here, we'll tighten up there. We've done better here. It's kind of conjugate with this section and that type of thing. And we'd like you to remember that when you do go through the bill. And if you have any changes, just remember that the program needs to be watched in its entirety and not change one section by another. And I think basically that answers all the questions that the committee had. And then from there, if there's any additional questions.
I suppose that you may not be in a position to answer the questions, the other questions that I had with regard to the effects of the policy decisions behind certain choices. I would wish that Mr. Spear were here, but we can ask him that again later. And how much since Tuesday, now you've indicated that you said that that in any case, the trust fund's not going to go broke under current law, 550, or Mr. Carlson's proposal from the Federation of Labor. Beyond that, how much did you look at Mr. Carlson's proposal since Tuesday, or well, any other comments you might have about it now?
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to look at the inner workings. I looked at the overall cost for it.
So at least right now you don't have any further comments about it until you look at it a bit more. Well, I confess that I'm a little interested in this. It might be a middle ground proposal of going to higher benefits in a two-year system. I think we could write a bill that way. It wouldn't be easy, but on the other hand, writing any bill on this subject is not easy. I'm not going to ask you for any backup on that now. We're going to be throwing some ideas around, so we're not going to ask the department to do a lot of work if we don't really have a definite proposal for it. I suppose what I'd like to have communicated back to Mr. Spear and Mr. Finley and some of the others are my concern, at least, and I'd like them to address it if they could next week. I think we may end up having one meeting on this bill and one meeting but I'd like someone to address the what I think is an unfortunate result, but probably not a major intention on the department's part, but it still does apparently result from the bill, and that is whether it's for some good, tidy administrative reason of getting rid of the dependents allowance, the result, in fact, is at least some people who are the people who are the least advantaged in the workforce would actually have their benefits reduced under the bill, and that does bother me a bit. And I'd like if you could mention to them that we'll probably be asking that question next week. I'd appreciate it, because somebody sitting anywhere in Alaska and making, say, $11,000 and has three kids and has employment problems is trying to work and pass a bill, it's pretty hard for all of Mr. Osterback or anybody else who's representing him to explain to him why his unemployment benefits went down as a result of the bill. And something means something more than just theoretical to him when he's looking at that. Are there any other questions?
I'd like to make one comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. For the record, can you indicate your name? I really should have done that.
My name is Rudy Ascaris. I'm the Chief of Accounts Contributions. On the Hospital 550, as we have it here, as Jen has said, it has somewhat of a balancing effect. If you increase benefits, you also have to determine where your funds are going to come from. And although the fund is solvent at this point, it's not an insurance, but if Alaska had some kind of economic disaster, that fund would go broke. So we have 10 schedules and we're at the top end of that schedule. We have to look at what we need to do to generate more revenues to finance the fund. And I think 550 takes care of that, as well as increases the benefits for the lower income bracket people.
It does for everybody except those who have two or three children, apparently, and then there is a difference.
Well, in that case there, we're asking to delete the dependency allowance, but we're also increasing the base.
From $18 to $52
a week.
At the same time, you're also cutting out 1,000 people, aren't you?
Which also bothers me, but just as you were talking, I had a question. Well, what is the experience in granting the people in the department? What is the experience in other states? How do they stand with just an overview? I don't expect you to go running off and research the thing for 3 hours, but just your current understanding with regard to the solvency of funds in other states. Are they better off or worse off than we are? What seems to have been the experience? Are there some funds that are now insolvent or have recently been? What's been happening in that regard?
The federal government right now is asking the states to take a look at their tax structure to make it more solvent, to avoid any borrowing from the federal government itself. There were some, I believe, some 21 or 20 states which had become insolvent and had to borrow funds from the federal government.
What period of years are you talking about? Was 2021?
This is last year.
In the last year.
When this happens, when we have to borrow funds from the federal government, that happened to us back in 1956 or 57, I think, when we had a quite high unemployment here in Alaska, and the tax structure wasn't...
Yeah, that was the year that Dwight Eisenhower tried to balance the budget, I think. So go ahead.
When this happens, then the employers would have to withstand the total tax under the FETA program to pay back some of that funds.
Well, like the FETA has been mentioned, that's the, since I've done my own payroll, I know very well what it is. So basically you're saying that the source for the borrowing from the feds is the FETA.
That's right, sir.
Form 940.
941.
I'm sorry, 941, the other one.
And
how frequently does that happen? If last year, say, there were 20 or 21 states that were insolvent, we hope temporarily because of an economic downturn, does that happen once every 3 or 4 years, or is that a once every 20-year thing, or what?
I would be able to answer that question. This is the first time since I've been working for the state, and I've been working for them for 20 years, that I believe it's, second time Alaska, it was in 1956 and 57 it happened. And this is the first time since then that I've known of states having to borrow. there are many states that have a very low tax base. Ours, fortunately, the legislature saw fit to pass a bill that would bring the insurance program to where it should be. But now we're getting to a point where we're at the high tax schedule, and our employers are paying a lot more at a higher tax rate. If we do experience any kind of economic disaster now, it wouldn't take long for our fund to be depleted. In through December of this year, we paid out something like close to $90 million in benefits, but we only took in about $66 million in revenues. So I guess what we're proposing here is to...
66.
As opposed to about approximately 90. If the fund solvency doesn't become any better than what it is now, we could have a problem in future years.
How much is in the fund right now, roughly?
Roughly about $70 million. And at one point, we had approximately $102 million. And with the turn down of the pipeline, we dropped down to about
Are we absolutely forced by federal law to have this strange system that I guess it works out that this money's kind of kept for us as a federal trust fund by the feds, and we get an incredibly low interest rate for it even though it's our trust fund? That, are we just stuck with that under federal law or what?
Well, our trust fund draws 5%.
5% on $100 million is a lot of money.
It is.
And another 3 or 4%, which it ought to be in any current, rather conservative investment or savings account or something like that, would be quite a bit more. Are we just stuck with having to do it that way because of the way the federal law is written and we can't do anything else in order to be in compliance?
If we wanted to stay within federal law and have a federal state program, then yes, the money would have to be provided. We cannot take that.
Suppose we just weren't in compliance at all, we just did it all ourselves. Would that be so much of an aberration we couldn't possibly afford to do it unless we did it over 2 or 3 or 4 year period, or what?
We'd look at that and try to figure out what we would need. We know what we're taxing now. On the federal unemployment tax, you would have to pay your full tax. You would not get your tax credit, so you'd have to pay $204, okay, rather than $20. The possibility would be to pay the federal government for $204, and then take the money that we would have taxed, minus that $204, put it into a fund for ourselves, and pay from the last program that is a feasibility.
Has any state done that?
No.
You had a question.
My question, Mr. Chairman, was along the same line. I just was wondering how much the federal contribution is and about what that amounts to dollar-wise.
Yeah, if we had $66 million last year, how much of that was from the federal contribution, or did that not count?
None at all.
Okay, the federal contributions, the $20 you pay per employee, goes to the federal government and then comes back to us to fund our administration program. Okay, so what we would have to do is we no longer receive that money, so then I don't know what our program costs.
So the feds provide administrative costs, but in fact the source of the trust fund is entirely from Alaskan employers and employees?
Right.
Well, you know, it would seem then that the feds are only paying the administrative costs, maybe $100 million.
Yeah.
We had $100 million, and we have tens, twenties, fifty, and $100 million, and we're stuck with a 4%. That's a pretty bad investment. 5%, I guess.
It fluctuates 4 and 5% anyway.
I guess if you don't know the figure right now, what I'd like to know is How much is that total federal contribution to administrative costs in 1 year? Say, oh, last fiscal year or estimated for the current fiscal year?
Mr. Chairman, I told you that a little bit.
Okay.
The budget for the elementary program runs about $8,000.
Which is less than the additional, which is less than the additional 2 or 3% interest we would get on our money if we did not have it in a very low savings account in Washington, D.C. Certainly seems ballpark. Don, you have something?
Mr. Spear, I was getting only 4%.
I thought it was 4. I thought somebody in the last week and a half was at 4.
Mr. Chairman, this does fluctuate. It can go. I believe the last report that I have received through September of this year was 5%. But yes, it also it can drop below 4. It fluctuates anyway.
Even 4 is an average. It fluctuates between 3 and 5.
Well, how does the federal scheme work the way the federal laws are written? Suppose somebody just intentionally goes out of compliance and sets up their own program. How does that tax that the employers within a state pay and ever end up benefiting that state's economy or the?
It never will.
It never will. So I guess it'd be a trade-off. We'd be worrying about having our employer tax go up and subsidize California or something, or to perhaps have a sounder investment circumstance for the trust fund. Well, I guess the only other question I've got is just a comment is I have two things. One of them is I'd like you people to look a little bit more closely at Mr. Carlson's proposal and his figures and formula and so forth, and then I'd like to hear from Mr. Spear and Finley and such about something on the policy decisions about some of these results, how they might suggest something else occur, particularly the people on the bottom line. Really, I don't have any comments. That doesn't matter.
Have you, to understand you say that you, the department has explored the benefit or lack of benefit of getting off the federal program? I mean, you looked into that and decided that that's not the thing to do?
We've heard the question arise, I think it arose last year, and we haven't looked into it to see what could actually happen in the actual cost. We know the overall picture. If you wanted a more detailed picture, we'd find out the you see what we do
now. Yeah, if it's not a great amount of work, I'd like to have some estimates of that. That is, if we went out of the federal program immediately, or if we did it in a two-year or whatever period, what effect it would have on the trust fund, on the administrative costs, and on the, of course, on the employer tax you already mentioned. That's probably the easiest part of it. Well, as some of the members and people here arrive a little later, I indicated to me in this meeting that we're intentionally having a short meeting because of our rather important calendar today. I want to get a chance to make sure I want to know what I'm voting on, and have some people at this table probably need to arm twist the votes for amendments and things like that. So we'll stand in adjournment, and next week we'll have one of our two committee days on this bill. I don't know which one.
I guess that's what it's about to be.
Yeah, we did have the same here.
Oh, my God.